I'm David Crowe. Thank you for tuning in to episode 187 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. Email me at david.crowe@theinfectiousmyth.com. That's Crowe with an E. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Infectious Myth. Listen every Tuesday at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time on PRN.FM or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or other programs. You can listen to any of the last five episodes over the phone by dialing the U.S. number 701-719-0990 and following the instructions. Just remember that you will be responsible for any long-distance charges. It might surprise you, but I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you. Send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show, what you like about it, what guests you like, what conversations you liked or did not like, and who you'd like to have on the show in the future. If you include your mailing address, I will send you a little thank you gift, which will be one of the bookmarks I make by hand using my own photographs. If you would like to sponsor this show, please contact me. You can make a one-time donation via PayPal using the email david.crowe@theinfectiousmyth.com or monthly donations at patreon.com/infectiousmyth, and that's P-A-T-R-E-O-N. We appreciate all our listeners, but if you want this show to continue to grow and improve, consider paying a small amount for the information you're gleaning, for the support you get for some of your non-mainstream ideas, and the challenges you get to others. I appreciate you commenting and suggesting guests. I appreciate your financial support as well. Thanks for listening and for recommending this show to your friends. And now to a very interesting and important interview. Dr. Remington Nevin is a Vermont-based physician, epidemiologist, and expert on the adverse effects of antimalarial drugs, particularly mefloquine. He is board certified in occupational medicine, public health, and general preventive medicine. Formerly, he was a U.S. Army major. Now he is executive director of the Quinism Foundation, dedicated to studying the medical disorders caused by mefloquine, tafenoquine, and related quinolone drugs. He has testified before governments in the U.S., Canada, and the U.K., has given evidence to the Irish Department of Defense. He's worked with lawyers in cases of injury from these drugs. Welcome back to the show, Dr. Nevin.
Yeah, thanks, David. Great to be back with you.
Yes. So we've talked about mefloquine before. It was a while ago, but let's go through some of the basics. So why was mefloquine seen as a more desirable malaria drug than some of the others that may have had lesser side effects?
Yeah, good question. So just a little bit more background. Mefloquine was developed by the U.S. military during the Vietnam era. It was intended as a replacement for chloroquine. There was a lot of resistance developing to chloroquine, and it was thought that the new drugs were needed for the military's use to ensure that we could operate worldwide without the fear of malaria. And it was the military's interest in having a convenient anti-malarial that I think made mefloquine seem quite desirable at the time. It's a weekly drug. And as a weekly drug, that facilitates commanders and units administering the drug under directly observed therapy during weekly formations. Rather than getting everyone together and watching everyone take their pill every day, they only had to do that once a week.
Well that's interesting. And so presumably military forces that were outside the main base, what do they call it, a forward operating position or something like that, that way there would be less time wasted giving out drugs as opposed to doing what they're supposed to be doing. But you also mentioned directly observed therapy. That implies to me that there was a problem with soldiers not wanting to take these drugs.
Well, I think there's always been concern among soldiers taking anti-malarial drugs because the anti-malarial drugs that we've used over the last three quarters of a century have had some fairly unpleasant side effects. This goes back to World War II when the drug Adabrin was ordered to be used among troops. And, oh, David, by the way, I'm hearing a train in the background.
That's okay.
Junction, a historic train junction in Vermont.
So, okay.
Please ignore the pleasant train sound.
When I interview people in places like New York or Washington, D.C., it's generally sirens. So this is a lot more rural and a lot more pleasant, I think.
Yeah, White River Junction is here along the Connecticut, right where the White River joins. And this was the natural pass through the Green Mountains to Burlington.
So this
evolved as a railroad town in the late 1800s. So Adabrin was really the first drug of this class to get a bad reputation among troops. Troops would complain of horrific insomnia, vivid dreams and nightmares back in World War II. It was known among the troops that this drug could turn soldiers psychotic on occasion. And of course, these same side effects were identified when mefloquine came into common use beginning in the 1990s. So it's not surprising that the military would want to observe these drugs being given to soldiers, because soldiers quite rightly had concerns about taking them.
And which were some of the major militaries that used it? Obviously the United States, but other country militaries?
Well, you know, interestingly, when mefloquine first came on the market in the United States in 1989, this was around the same time that the World Health Organization voiced some fairly serious concerns with the drug. And as a result of that, U.S. military physicians opposed widespread use of the drug for several years. In fact, in the early 90s, I've seen a few publications that said it was unlikely that mefloquine would ever be used. Meanwhile, some other countries' militaries, particularly Canada, mm-hmm. took a profound interest in mefloquine and made it its first-line drug even before it was licensed there. And it was only after the Somalia campaign in 1993 that the U.S. military began to use mefloquine formally as its first-line drug. They were joined by the United Kingdom, eventually by Ireland. But interestingly, the Australian military that licensed mefloquine, I believe, in January 1993, they've always had concerns with mefloquine, and it's always been formally a second or third line drug to be used after the safer daily drugs.
And a lot of people outside Canada might not know it, but during the Somalia campaign, there are the Canadian troops killed a couple of local civilians, and some people think that this was related to the mefloquine. This became a huge scandal within Canada, resulted in the Minister of Defense resigning, resulted in the head of the armed forces either resigning or being fired. So you've briefly, in passing, mentioned some of the side effects. But what do you think are some of the most important side effects of mefloquine?
Well, we really shouldn't refer to these as side effects. Side effects imply a benign, reversible process. What we're seeing with mefloquine, and actually with all drugs of this class, the quinoline class, is that these drugs cause a particular kind of poisoning, a poisoning of the central nervous system. And this poisoning causes a disease. It's no different than lead poisoning. So a child who's exposed to high levels of lead suffers what we call acute lead encephalopathy, and that we call plumbism, or lead poisoning. And that can lead to chronic lead encephalopathy, which is associated with lifelong deficits in cognition and changes in personality. And it's the exact same thing with mefloquine. Mefloquine poisoning, or acute quinoline encephalopathy, is associated with a risk of chronic disability, chronic neuropsychiatric effects caused by the drug injuring the central nervous system.
One of the things in passing I asked you before was whether there was a relationship between mefloquine and the fluoroquinolone antibiotics. All I knew is that they both contained fluorine, and you told me that they're quite different chemicals, although, as I said, they do both contain fluorine. But what's interesting is that that's another complaint about the fluoroquinolone antibiotics, is that they basically are locked into your body so that if you have an adverse reaction, it doesn't like go away with time because the drug is always there. And do you think that's related to the use of fluorine in the drugs, or am I off base?
Well, so this is a complicated question. I'm often asked to distinguish between symptoms of quinoline poisoning. So methylquinone, chloroquine, quinine, tofenoquine, and poisoning by the fluoroquinolones.
Right.
And there's only one letter difference between quinoline and quinolone. But chemically, they're very different structures.
Mm-hmm.
The fluoroquinolones, they all contain the trifluoromethyl group, and that's a chemical group that's designed to impart lipophilicity and protection against metabolism. And some of the anti-malarial quinolines also have a trifluoromethyl group on them. But what we see is among the quinolines, a common CNS toxicity, whether or not there's a trifluoromethyl group. So I don't think it's a trifluoromethyl group or the fluorine that's primarily responsible for methylquinone's toxicity. But you're absolutely correct. There are problems with drugs that contain that group because of their high lipophilicity and tendency to persist in tissues. And there has been a reasonable concern expressed that although the trifluoromethyl group has been thought to be metabolically inert, there does seem to be some evidence that the human body is able to liberate the fluorine atoms. And that's particularly problematic because, for example, methylquinone is 250 milligrams per dose, and a large proportion of that is actually the weight from the fluorine atoms. So if any of that fluorine is being liberated, a person could have a fairly significant fluorine dose. But I think that toxicity, whatever toxicity from fluorine exists from methylquinone, is probably secondary in importance to the primary neurotoxicity of the drug that comes from the fact that it's a quinoline.
Okay. Now, the malaria parasite is believed to circulate in the blood system, I understand?
It is. Yeah, the malaria is a disease of the blood.
Right. And so presumably they want the part of the design of methylquinone was a drug that would also circulate in the drug, but does it go other places like you mentioned?
Yeah, right. So good point. And this is the real tragedy of drugs of the quinoline class that are developed for this indication. So in order for a quinoline drug to be effective against the malaria parasite, it has to penetrate multiple barrier membranes and finally end up in the food vacuole. And the same properties that result in the drug penetrating and accumulating to therapeutic concentrations in that food vacuole also render the drug very likely to penetrate and accumulate into the central nervous system. And it's really rather unfortunate that studies show very clearly a larger proportion of this drug, methylquinone, is likely found in brain rather than in the target organ, meaning the blood. So only about 1-2% of every ingested methylquinone tablet ends up at its intended point of action in the blood. And the remainder ends up in the bile, in the enterohepatic circulation. It ends up in the lung. It ends up in the heart.
Right.
And it ends up in the brain.
And is the parasite goes after the food vacuoles? Is that the how?
No. That's a part of the parasite structure. So the drug needs to make its way into the red blood cells,
right.
And then from the red blood cells, it needs to make it into the parasite, and it does that very effectively because of the structure of the drug. It tends to accumulate in acidic vacuoles in the
right.
body.
Mm-hmm.
So peroxisomes and lysosomes, these seem to be structures that the drug is very much attracted to. And some studies have been published showing that this drug accumulates at hundreds or thousands the concentration in serum in these particular organelles. And that's problematic because that very likely has something to do with the mechanism of neurotoxicity of these drugs, although we really don't understand
right.
fully.
So the parasite has these food vacuoles, but the human body has similar structures, and
yeah,
so right. naturally,
yeah, that's right. And this property, the lipophilicity, meaning the fat binding properties of methylquinone, the fact that methylquinone can very easily penetrate blood brain barriers and other barrier membranes, and that the drug accumulates in acidic vacuoles. This property has never been adequately considered by the malariology community in the context of drug safety. And I think that's the real tragedy with this class of drug, that the properties that make it so effective as an anti-malarial also very likely are responsible for its toxicity, which can be associated with permanent disability.
Right. Was it approved on the basis of its effect on malaria symptoms, or was it approved based on, some kind of laboratory marker or something like that?
Well, so mefloquine is an interesting drug in that it actually doesn't cure the infection. It's what's called a suppressive anti-malarial agent or a suppressive prophylactic drug. When used for prevention of malaria, all it's doing is it's keeping the infection down, but there's still residual levels of parasites, very likely in the blood, but also in the liver. And so a definitive treatment is required in many cases to rid the body of any remaining infection. In the World War II, it was known that this type of drug, a suppressive prophylaxis, really wasn't ideal. And we've been searching for what's known as a truly causal prophylaxis, a drug that essentially sterilizes all areas of the body where this infection could hide. Of the drug. And this is, of course, the supposed promise of tofenaquine, a new drug of this class, which is being considered by drug regulators today.
Right. Maybe we can we can talk about that. What stimulated this conversation was that you said that you had been to an FDA meeting where they approved tofenaquine by a vote of 12-1, despite you raising some concerns about it. I don't know if there were other people who also raised concerns. But what is the difference between tofenaquine and mefloquine?
Well, I was at the July 12th meeting of the Antimicrobial Drugs Advisory Committee. It's an independent committee that's organized by FDA, consisting of scientists and members of the professions and public that advise FDA on pending drug applications. And much to my surprise and disappointment, the advisory committee voted in favor of the question, had the drug sponsor demonstrated the safety of tofenaquine. And of course, I and our foundation strongly disagree with that assessment. We don't believe that adequate preclinical safety testing has been done on tofenaquine. Tofenaquine is an 8-aminoquinoline drug, and it was known during World War II that all drugs tested in this class were found to exhibit fairly striking evidence of central nervous system neurotoxicity. Nearly 140 drugs were tested in this class, and they were all found to be uniformly neurotoxic. So it would be very surprising to me for tofenaquine not to share these neurotoxic properties. And there's no evidence that the drug designers or the current drug sponsors rationally designed the drug in any way to avoid this neurotoxicity. So I expect in due course we're going to see the same very clear evidence of neurotoxicity that we've seen from other members of this class and from related drugs such as mefloquine. Now, the excitement for tofenaquine is twofold. It's viewed as a replacement for primaquine, which requires 14 days of therapy to eradicate the liver stages of disease. A 1 or 2 day course of tofenaquine, 1 day as proposed, but I suspect it may be stretched out mm-hmm. to the future. Certainly more convenient than a 14 day course of primaquine, but at what cost? The accelerated dosing schedule as a result of the enhanced lipophilicity of tofenaquine relative to primaquine, and it's that lipophilicity, as we mentioned, that very likely is going to be correlated with increased neurotoxicity. So we'll see what happens as this drug is deployed worldwide. It hasn't been approved yet, but I do expect approval to be imminent for this indication.
One of the advantages of a new drug to a drug company is that is eligible for a new patent, and there's also exclusive marketing rights. So although this is part of an old class of drugs, like you are saying it's been around since at least World War II. This is presumably a new chemical and therefore has a new patent.
Well, actually, David, the financial incentives here are quite different than what you might imagine. The public's not aware of the very unusual financial incentives that have very likely promoted the recent push to license tofenequin. So let me give you just a little background on this. Tofenequin was actually developed way back in the 70s and 80s, and it languished during clinical development. The last major trials on tofenequin were in the late 1990s, early 2000s, conducted among a group of Australian veterans. These trials, the ethics of these trials have been under scrutiny recently, and there's going to be an Australian Senate inquiry looking into the propriety and safety of these trials and whether these trials have actually caused permanent disability among some Australian members of their military. But that's somewhat beside the point. That the drug then languished in development, and it was all but abandoned in the mid-2000s. And it didn't seem as though either GlaxoSmithKline, the current license holder or patent holder from the U.S. military, or the U.S. military, or anyone else would pursue development of tofenequin. And it was only in 2007 when Congress passed amendments to the Food and Drug Act that there was renewed interest in tofenequin. And that's because tofenequin as a drug for malaria would become eligible for something called a priority review voucher if it was approved. And what a priority review voucher does, if one is awarded to a drug company by FDA as a reward for bringing a new malaria drug to market, is that priority review voucher can be traded on the open market, and it can command a price as high as $350 million or more. And the holder of a PRV can then shave many months off the time it takes for FDA to review any other drug. So imagine if a drug has the next big blockbuster cholesterol medication that could make a billion or more in sales a year. Well, every month that drug is licensed faster than normal could translate into hundreds of millions of dollars in extra sales.
Well, that's a little bit weird because presumably, you know, considering a drug for approval at the FDA is a process that takes time and, you know, takes scientists to do the research. So I can see if you put more scientists on the job, you could do it faster.
Yeah.
But it could also be that you just do a sloppier job of approval because you know that you have to do it faster.
Well, so yeah, so there's two questions there. Does priority review decrease the quality of oversight that FDA puts into a new drug application? I would say not at this point. I don't see any strong evidence of this. I was disappointed in the quality of FDA's review of tofenequin. Tofenequin itself qualified for priority review automatically on the basis of it being a malaria drug. I disagree profoundly with some of the conclusions of FDA scientists that spoke at the advisory committee meeting, but I suspect those scientists would have made the same errors had they had more time to review. So I don't necessarily think priority review increases the public's risk as a result of sloppy review. Most of the time, what's happening is they're just butting to the front of the line. So the time it takes under review is probably the same, but they're butting ahead of competitors. But more to the point, you know, what is the drug company's interest in tofenequin? GlaxoSmithKline does not stand to make any significant profit from selling tofenequin or as it's going to be branded, Krintafil. They're not going to make much money selling this because the number of Americans who would require Krintafil or tofenequin is very few, a few hundred or perhaps a few thousand at most. That's hardly worth their effort. Similarly, they're not going to make money selling it overseas in countries that either don't have drug licensing infrastructure or that will essentially rubber stamp a similar drug application for their version of tofenequin. Glaxo intends to give this drug away or have its distribution sponsored by the malaria elimination community. So Glaxo's interest is either purely altruistic or their interest is primarily in this priority review voucher. And I suspect the economics of tafenoquin really only makes sense for Glaxo in the context of this priority review voucher. They I suspect, may either want to monetize the voucher by selling it to a competitor so that they can license another drug more quickly, or perhaps Glaxo is thinking of bringing to market a big ticket drug in the near future, and they intend to use this rare priority review voucher to speed one of their new drugs to market. That's the explanation that's most likely, I think.
It's a little bit like playing Monopoly, I think. I think one of the other reasons could be just that it would make the company look better. That if you're giving away a drug, whether it's altruistic or not, it looks altruistic, and therefore you can advertise yourself as sacrificing profits to cure malaria around the world.
Yeah, well, sure. I'm sure there's some public relations interest. But the companies, almost certainly, Glaxo knows, or certainly ought to know, of the controversy surrounding tafenoquin. And the company either knows or reasonably ought to know about these concerns that the drug has this neurotoxic potential. And of course, any marketing of this drug in a jurisdiction that has strong consumer protections, that has a strong tort system, could expose the company potentially to very large damages.
Yeah, so there is a downside if this whole thing backfires.
Yeah, there's downside, and that's why I've always really wondered. I've actually questioned whether Glaxo intends to market this drug domestically at all. I would be somewhat surprised if Glaxo makes tafenoquin available domestically, because the first patient that takes tafenoquin and develops tinnitus or develops a dizziness or develops a chronic mood disturbance, that's a very straightforward case to make in court.
So it is a possibility that they got the approval, will not market it because they got this benefit for approving a drug. It reminds me that there were some efforts made to encourage people to test drugs on children, because a lot of drugs had not been tested on children, and that resulted in drugs being tested on children that had no real use, like anti-cholesterol drugs being tested on children just in order to get a benefit from the FDA in terms of the marketing.
Well, some pediatricians would disagree with you that kids don't need anti-cholesterol drugs.
Well, that may be, but I would think that the market, even if there are some that do, the market would be much smaller.
Yeah.
a question that came up in my mind, these drugs are not given to soldiers because the soldiers have malaria. It's given to soldiers as a preventive because they don't want them to get malaria. Is that correct? It's given to everybody, right?
So it's a little more complicated than that. So yeah, in general, soldiers don't get a whole lot of malaria, and that's because our malaria prevention strategies are working, and a small part of that is the use of prophylactic antimalarials on occasion. We can do a lot to prevent malaria in our soldiers simply through education insect avoidant measures. But yeah, prophylactic drug administration has been a part of our military malaria prevention strategy. It's a little more complicated because there's a form of malaria that relapses, that hides in the liver. And so you come home from deployment, and we have for many years given soldiers what's called presumptive anti-relapse therapy or terminal prophylaxis to eradicate any liver stage infection, and we've used Primaquin for that, but it's possible the military may want to switch to tafenoquin for that at some point in the future. So that's sort of prevention of malaria, but really it's treatment of presumed infection. So it's a little subtle. Someone who's clinically ill with malaria is unlikely to get one of these drugs, because at least for now, because there are safer and better and more effective drug combinations that are recommended to treat acute malaria. But again, very, very, relatively very few military personnel ever contract malaria.
Right. So if you did contract malaria, you would presumably not be in the field anymore. You'd be in a hospital getting cured.
Well, you'd be surprised. The U.S. military presumptively treats a lot of cases of presumed malaria out in the field. The problem is diagnostics is very difficult. So if you're out in a highly endemic area and you're a few hours or a few days away from definitive diagnosis and someone comes down with fever and the usual sort of vague symptoms, that has to be assumed to be malaria unless proven otherwise. And the problem is the tests that we can do rapidly in the field, they really don't have good sensitivity in non-immune Western residents. Someone could have a fairly significant and potentially imminently life-threatening malaria infection, and they would test negative on these rapid tests. We see this all the time. So the U.S. military does presumptively treat quite a number of people for malaria, and if they are treated effectively, we may never know if they actually had malaria. It's only when folks get really sick and are admitted to hospital and these definitive tests are done that we get a confirmed diagnosis.
Do they look for the parasite with some of these tests, or are they PCR?
So in non-immune folks like us who don't have any childhood exposure to malaria, really the only way to diagnose this is to draw repeat blood samples and smear them on slides and stain them and look carefully for these malaria parasites. And it takes an expert microscopist to do this. It's very different than in native populations in endemic areas, because they have a much higher parasite load when they first manifest symptoms. So the disease is easier to detect. It can be quite cryptic in non-immune Western travelers.
Right. And is there also a danger of mistaking symptoms for malaria when they're actually caused by something else?
Oh, sure. All the time. So for example, when the U.S. military deployed thousands of personnel on the Ebola mission, prevention of malaria and adherence to malaria prophylaxis was considered very critical for obvious reasons, right? Because if any soldier exhibited evidence of a fever, then given the context, they would have to assume it was Ebola.
Right.
And that would be disastrous. And so it's very interesting, the Ebola mission, during which time we deployed thousands of troops for many months, the U.S. military chose to use the daily drug Malarone or Atovaquone Proguanil. And I think our experiences during that deployment demonstrated to the military that we don't need a drug like Mefloquine. We don't need a weekly drug that is administered under directly observed therapy. Those soldiers who deployed took their Malarone religiously every day because they knew they didn't want to be diagnosed with a fever. And I think when the grand totals came in, I think something like four or five U.S. troops developed malaria out of many thousands of person months of exposure. So a remarkably effective malaria prevention strategy. And it just goes to show you that all the supposed promise and necessity of Mefloquine and this new drug, Tafenoquine, is really overstated. Maybe 10 years earlier or so, we deployed a few hundred Marines to that same area in Liberia for a humanitarian mission. And the military leaders were relying on Mefloquine, thinking that the troops were taking their Mefloquine, and several dozen troops had to be evacuated with suspected malaria. So that shows you the contrast between how Mefloquine works in practice and how the safer, better tolerated drug Malarone works.
And do you blame that on the soldiers not taking the Mefloquine or on the Mefloquine not preventing the malaria?
No. The fault is always with leadership, David. The fault is always with leadership. So leaders need to listen to their soldiers. And if they had listened to their soldiers, or in this case their Marines, what they would hear is that these Marines stopped taking Mefloquine often weeks prior because they were having side effects. They were having the side effects listed in the product label: anxiety, depression. In some cases, they were having horrific nightmares and insomnia. And the drug company and the U.S. military's policies actually said you need to stop taking the drug if you develop these symptoms. In order for Mefloquine to be used in accordance with the drug label, Military personnel need to be advised that if they experience any psychiatric symptom during use, they need to stop the drug, because as we know now, these could be the first warning sign of this neurotoxicity.
And as you say, that this neurotoxicity, if you develop it, is not necessarily going to go away. It could stay with you for years or for, yeah, forever.
Well, so neurotoxicity is by definition in almost all cases permanent, because the central nervous system doesn't regenerate itself, except right. in very good cases.
You mentioned a similarity to lead poisoning. You know, if you have lead poisoning, it can be with you for life. But I believe there are ways to try to, what do they call that process of removing lead from your body, chelating lead. Is there anything similar with these drugs where you can try to actually remove it from your body?
No, I think by the time that mefloquine poisoning manifests, it's unfortunately too late. So the key is prevention. And so that this is why our foundation and our work, my publications, we emphasize the importance of adhering to these boxed label warnings. So with mefloquine, the way to use mefloquine in a more safe manner is to carefully counsel your patients that any psychiatric symptom, to include something as seemingly mild as a vivid dream or insomnia, could be the only warning that you get of an acute encephalopathy. And this acute encephalopathy can be associated with symptoms such as psychosis or confusion, paranoia, anxiety, panic, and these symptoms often prevent compliance with the drug label insert. So it's critical that at the earliest indication of symptoms, one discontinues the drug. And it's hoped, we don't know, but it's hoped that if you discontinue the drug immediately at the onset of the very first warning symptoms, you can prevent the more serious chronic effects. And in my experience, almost every veteran that I've evaluated that has chronic effects from mefloquine poisoning, they continued taking the drug despite experiencing these prodromal symptoms. So they had nightmares after their first couple doses and they continued taking the drug.
Which is kind of a macho thing, right? Like, I'm in the military, maybe in the special forces, I can put up with pain. So this is nothing I can handle.
Well, there are many reasons. There are many reasons. So in some cases, they just didn't know. They just didn't know it was due to the drug. They attributed their insomnia or nightmares to their situation. Mm-hmm. And only after talking to other mefloquine veterans do they realize that this wasn't their circumstances. This was the drug. In other cases, they were ordered to take the drug. In some cases, soldiers were formally involuntarily intoxicated. They were experiencing these symptoms and they were forced to take additional doses. We call that involuntary intoxication. In some other cases, as you mentioned, individuals thought that they could labor through or toughen through these symptoms. In some cases, they're given medical advice that these symptoms will go away after a few additional doses. There's a name for that, David. That's called malpractice.
Yes. Well, I was laughing because I've heard that before in other contexts where I just keep it up and the symptoms will go away. And I think what doctors don't realize is that often symptoms go away for their patients because the patients stop taking the drugs. The doctors conclude that the patients are taking the drugs, the symptoms went away, not thinking that maybe the symptoms went away because the patients stopped taking the drugs. I wanted to ask, you know, one of the benefits of mefloquine seems to be that you give everybody the same drug directly observed once a week. But if you actually use it as it's supposed to be used, you now have to give some of the soldiers a different drug, maybe a daily drug. And so the whole benefit of mefloquine goes away if you use it properly.
Because that's exactly right. So mefloquine had the promise to be this fantastic silver bullet that the military could fire once and forget. You line everyone up, you give them the pill, no malaria, no worries. The problem is, though, all of the unique requirements for the safe use of mefloquine take away any and all of its presumed advantages. So as you say, let's say you have a unit of 100 soldiers all lined up taking their first dose of mefloquine. Our experience is that after that first dose, you're going to expect 10%-ish to experience one or more of these prodromal symptoms, the vivid dreams, the nightmares, insomnia. And so you'll need to assess everyone to identify those roughly 10% of folks and switch them to a different medicine. And now you're going to have to switch them to a daily medicine because there aren't weekly alternatives. And then with each additional dose, you're going to find more and more folks that are similarly contraindicated to drug. And if you do fully assess your population of 100 soldiers for side effects, what you'll find is a large minority, if not a majority, will eventually have to switch to another drug. And so the logistical hassle of using this drug safely is simply not worth it. Now, some countries' militaries, the Irish military, developed a very interesting solution to this problem. What they told their troops was, well, if you have side effects, come forward. We'll give you another drug, but you'll be disqualified from any future missions. And not surprisingly, the Irish military found that very few soldiers came forward to report side effects. And the Irish military should have expected roughly 10, 20, 30% of its personnel to come forward reporting side effects. They seemed quite unsurprised, quite intellectually disinterested when a vanishingly small percentage of troops reported side effects. Obviously, that was convenient for them, but they knew or ought to have known that what was taking place was their soldiers either were continuing to take the drug, risking chronic effects as a result, or were simply not taking it and risking a potentially
because then they didn't have anything. I mean, that is sort of a classic example of insane management. I mean, what were soldiers going to do if they couldn't go on missions? They were going to be kept to the base back in Ireland, and all their buddies would get shipped overseas?
So this is an example of gross negligence, David, obviously. What the Irish military did in their use of that drug was indefensible. There's simply no defense for that policy. They knew or ought to have known that soldiers would be injured and harmed as a result. Now they would contend that not being allowed to go on a future mission to Chad or Liberia or Cote d'Ivoire isn't a career-ending move, that there are plenty of other deployment opportunities. But Irish soldiers I've spoken to have told me a very different story, that you really don't want to be that nail that sticks up. You don't want to be the different soldier that can't accommodate your boss's requests. And so I do think policies like that are punitive, that punish an individual, either directly or indirectly, for reporting side effects, really have no place. And should be considered negligent.
All right. One of the things that you've worked with, and I think this is how I got into this originally, was talking to a former soldier who knew about the efforts of other soldiers into trying to deal with the side effects of this drug and try to get it taken out of the military. And there have been inquiries and activism occurring in, you know, Australia, Canada, obviously the United States, England, Ireland. I mean, what do you know about these efforts to try to change things that are being led by these former soldiers?
Well, so as with many things, you know, the initial identification of a problem comes from the rank and file, or comes from the folks out in the field. We'd like to think that drug companies and militaries and the medical profession are the ones to identify nascent epidemics, but quite often that's not the case. Mm-hmm. So we need to listen to veterans. One thing I've learned in my profession, working as a military epidemiologist and working with veterans, is veterans usually know what they're talking about, and we ignore their concerns at our perils. Time and again, this has been shown to be true, whether it's Agent Orange or PTSD from Vietnam or the atomic veterans after World War II. We must listen to our veterans and take their concerns seriously. That being said, it's good to see after roughly 25 years, most countries that have used mefloquine have at least acknowledged tacitly that there's a problem with this drug. So it began with Australia never using this drug as a first-line agent. France in the early 2000s, all but dropped use of mefloquine. Some other European countries did the same. But among the remaining English-speaking countries, the United States began to push mefloquine to the back of the medicine cabinet beginning in 2009. By 2013, it declared it formally a drug of last resort. The UK followed a few years later, as did Canada, very reluctantly, but they did formally deprioritize mefloquine. Now, Canada is an interesting case because Canada would claim that there's no problem at all with mefloquine. And their policy simply reflects, you know, the unsubstantiated concerns of their veterans. I suspect that their policy, their refusal to admit the dangers of mefloquine, in fact, reflects their concerns of significant civil liability for what
yes,
the legal use of the drug during the Somalia campaign.
I only laughed because I'm Canadian, and this seems like a classic Canadian bureaucratic thing, is follow the Americans. Even when the Americans have changed direction, we will continue on the path that we have set for ourselves.
Well, so David, it's very interesting. So you'll recall, as a Canadian, you'll recall the warm relationship that Canada had with the United States at that time, in the early 90s. It was an unusually close relationship, and Canada at the time, I think, was seeking to curry significant favor with the United States. And I suspect it's for that reason that the Canadian government submitted to the use of mefloquine among its troops during the Somalia campaign. So Canada had not licensed mefloquine, but years earlier, Canada had shown a great interest in making use of mefloquine and in making itself useful to the U.S. military by demonstrating the use of mefloquine before the U.S. military was ready to do the same. Mefloquine is not the sort of drug Canada would ever develop. It's not the sort of drug the Canadian military has ever needed. And the Canadian military oddly went all in with this drug back in late 92, early 93, when they gave it to 1,000 members of the Canadian Airborne Regiment deploying to Somalia before the drug was even licensed in Canada.
Right. I mean, if this drug was critical to the what's called in Canada the Somalia affair, the yeah. deaths of these two Somali civilians at the hands of Canadian soldiers. Yeah. I mean, it also resulted in dissolving, I think it was called the Canadian Parachute or the Canadian Airborne Regiment. Yeah. So that was a pretty big hit to lose the Minister of Defense, the head of the armed forces, and to actually dissolve a regiment, all because of this affair that might have been caused by enthusiastic use of a drug.
Well, David, it was. The Somali affair is entirely the result of mefloquine. The behavioral changes, and in particular, the extreme acts of violence that occurred in Somalia were the result of unrecognized mefloquine poisoning. Master Corporal Clayton Matchy, the individual that's seen in those photos with Shadena Roan moments before he was beaten to death, it's now understood that he was in the grips of a very severe psychosis at the time that he engaged in that beating death. Canadian Parliament took testimony some time ago from another soldier who was there that overheard Clayton Matchy pointing out imagined camel spiders that had filled the bunker. And he was beating at the camel spiders along the wall and eventually beating Shadena Roan, who he presumably was hallucinating was covered in camel spiders. And worrisomely, a few weeks prior to this, Clayton Matchy had been home with his wife, Marge Matchy, on leave. And it was very obvious that he was suffering from mefloquine intoxication at the time. He was having horrific anxiety. He was having crippling insomnia. He awoke next to his wife in bed one night, dripping in sweat. His face was completely white. And he was gripped by fear because he was hallucinating the presence of some sort of fanged monster at the foot of his bed, and for an hour he sat with his wife trying to pray this monster away. This is extraordinary.
Yes.
That this soldier who was going back into a combat zone with an automatic weapon was suffering full-on psychosis from this. And the Canadian government refuses to acknowledge the overwhelming evidence of this. And it never once identified this problem in him. And the real tragedy is that the use of mefloquine on that deployment was legally authorized only within the guise of what was to have been a safety study, requiring the Canadian military to carefully monitor these soldiers for precisely those kinds of side effects. There was no other legal rationale for the use of an unlicensed drug. You know, the Canadian military can't give its soldiers LSD because it thinks it would help them, because LSD is not a licensed drug. And right. Similarly, it can't give soldiers mefloquine if it's unlicensed, except within the parameters of an approved safety study.
And I think you've illustrated very well that the Canadian government, the Canadian military, has a right to be fearful that they would be on the hook for significant compensation.
Well, they were sued for $1 billion. There was a class action suit that tried to get underway several years ago, but it was interrupted many times. And tragically, it made its way through to the Ontario Superior Court, I believe is the name, up in North Bay. I went to attend a hearing last December, and the judge ruled very recently. The judge ruled, I think quite reluctantly, that there was an inordinate delay in bringing the case to trial. And so it's possible that a new plaintiff will resurrect the class action suit, but it's also entirely possible that this episode will just quietly fade away and there won't be opportunities to resolve it through the legal system. What recourse there may be might be through the political system, through some sort of inquiry at some point in the future.
Right, and maybe one of the most important things would be that Canadians would learn that it wasn't the behavior of their soldiers, that it was a drug-induced epidemic, which
And more importantly, that it wasn't the rank and file of the Canadian Airborne Regiment, but senior Canadian military and political leaders that were responsible for the Somalia affair.
Right. Before we go on to the Quinism Foundation, which I want to close with, do you know anything more about the case of Robert Bales? Because last time we talked, you said it wasn't really known whether or not he had taken mefloquine, although you suspected he had. He left the base in Afghanistan and killed, I believe, 16 civilians. Do you know anything more about that case?
So I was retained by his legal team, and I've assisted them in writing some briefs in support of his appeal. The evidence now points overwhelmingly, in my opinion, to his having been involuntarily intoxicated with mefloquine on at least one deployment, particularly his first Iraq deployment. There's good evidence supported by independent affidavits that Bales was ordered to take mefloquine in formation. And there's every indication that he was suffering hallucinations during his first Iraq deployment. So if that is the case, assuming, as I think is true, that is the case, then that would explain a lot of the chronic symptoms that Bales subsequently complained of. He wasn't properly evaluated. He didn't receive a proper psychiatric diagnosis really at any point up until his trial. I believe several months before his final deployment to Afghanistan, he was even told he had no psychiatric problems. He had no psychiatric diagnosis. But it's obvious he was laboring under several significant chronic psychiatric symptoms, all of which are very plausibly attributable to the effects of chronic mefloquine poisoning as a result of his initial involuntary intoxication. Now, whether he was exposed to mefloquine in Afghanistan or not is less certain. But I think it's not essential to demonstrate that he was exposed to mefloquine in Afghanistan, because we know that the chronic effects of poisoning can include symptoms up to and including intermittent psychosis.
And what you've said is that these symptoms don't go away. So if you were poisoned in Iraq, then years later in Afghanistan, there's no reason to believe that you wouldn't be still suffering from those side effects.
Yeah, well, so the important thing in the case of Robert Bales is whether he was laboring under some form of psychosis at the time of the incident in question. And on reviewing the record of trial, on reviewing the evidence that was presented, it's very obvious that that night, the night of the incident in question, he had been on guard duty earlier in the evening. And the record of trial shows that he had claimed to see lights, flashing lights, a signaling of lights between two villages. And it shows that he observed this flashing go on for a period of around 15 minutes. And he even pointed out this flashing to someone else who was on guard duty with him. And apparently the other person on guard duty did not see any flashing lights at all. Now, when you see something that someone else does not see over a period of 15 minutes, there's a simple explanation for that. Visual hallucinations.
Yes. Okay, well, we don't have much time left, so let's go on to the Quinism Foundation. Why did you set it up, and what is its goal?
Well, so what we're describing is a disease, David. So methylcobalamin poisoning causes a disease. Chronic quinoline encephalopathy, or what I call neuropsychiatric quinism, is a disease. We know the cause. It's methylcobalamin poisoning. We know the pathophysiology, injury to various parts of the brain and brainstem, and we know the signs and symptoms of this disease. Chronic insomnia, chronic anxiety, chronic nightmares, psychosis, neurological problems. So methylcobalamin poisoning is a disease. Mm-hmm. And the purpose of our foundation is to raise awareness of this disease, the family of disorders caused by quinoline poisoning, but specifically neuropsychiatric quinism or chronic quinoline encephalopathy. So our foundation has great ambition, great aims. We're starting small. We'll be supporting scientific publications, attendance at scientific conferences, raising awareness online and among policy makers. So that involves a lot of travel and publications and some advocacy work. But we're very pleased at the feedback we're getting. We're giving this condition a name, David, and we're letting folks affected by it know that this isn't all in their head, that this is an actual medical disorder. And I think that in due course, we're going to recognize that quinism or quinoline poisoning the cause of a hidden epidemic among this generation of veterans.
And you have a website, because I will include that in the show notes.
Yeah, our website is Quinism.org, Quinism.org. And just a brief note about our name. Quinism is an obsolete term. It was used to describe quinine poisoning over 20 years ago. But all of these drugs are based on quinine. They're structurally related to quinine. So we've repurposed the name Quinism to describe the family of disorders caused by quinoline poisoning.
Okay. Thank you very much for another illuminating conversation. I think this will be very useful for people who don't know much about this, and hopefully it will direct people to your foundation and the work of yourself and to the many soldiers who have worked on this, often for the benefit of future soldiers to help them avoid these drugs. So thank you very much for joining me today.
Yeah, it's been great to be with you, David. Thanks so much.
Goodbye, then.
Yeah, take care.
Thank you for listening to episode 187 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com, like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth, follow us on Twitter and Instagram @infectiousmyth, commit to monthly donations of any amount at patreon.com/infectiousmyth. Until next week, thank you and goodbye.